Okay, I got a bunch of stuff this week, so jumping straight into it. And the stuff is going to be mostly centered around some data breach stuff and a whole bunch of really active things on Twitter. If you've been watching my Twitters the last couple of days, you will know what I mean already, but we will get back to that in just a moment. The data breach stuff. So have I been prone as, I've mentioned this before, but a lot of data gets sent through to me, and it is hard work staying on top of it all, validating it, doing disclosures if I have to, not to mention the actual process of loading it in, pumping it not just into the table storage that's been there for the last 4.5 years now, 4.5 years already, and also pumping it into the table storage, which now drives the hash sets, which Mozilla and 1Password sit on top of as well. So there's a lot of work on a per breach basis. So be that as it may, I did start working through the backlog. And the three that I loaded this week. So number one was an Indian motoring site called Gaadi, G-A-A-D-I. 4.3 million people there. That was in 2015. Usernames, email and IP addresses, genders and plain text passwords. Now this was 2015. I was about to say, like, you can kind of cut them a little bit of a slack for the plain text passwords because it was a while ago, but 2015 is not long enough ago to cut slack for storing passwords in the plane. So that was not a good situation. Now, fortunately, that did also give me a bunch of passwords to put into Pwned Passwords. So I am building up the Pwned Passwords list at the moment. There's about 60 million plus new ones on top of what is already there in the live system. So I think I'm getting close to the point of doing a V3. I mentioned this on Twitter yesterday. For the people that were asking, I've got no intentions of changing the API for V3. The only thing I have to manage is the cache expiration, because I've got a 30-day cache expiration, 31-day cache expiration on the API at the moment, just to cache the bejesus out of it, because it doesn't change much. I need to start thinking in the lead up to when I want to release this, how to back off the cache expiration such that when I do push this out, people are getting fresh data. Now, having said that, it's also not super critical, because if I do push this out and someone does a search and it says this password is okay, and it's actually not because it's been in a newer breach, well, you've just had months and months of it being okay anyway. So this is not like a mission critical, must time it right for everyone. But it will take a bit of thought, and it will just be business as usual for everyone consuming it. You'll just get slightly larger responses. So for argument's sake, if I wait until I get to 600 million records, you're going to get responses which are on average about 20% larger than the 500 million records at the moment. But that should be fine. So, all right, that was Gaadi. Now, incidentally, you'll see in this one and another one I'm about to mention, I tagged vigilante_PW, and I said this breach was previously reported by vigilante_PW. One of the challenges I've got when loading these breaches is, do I need to get in touch with the company or not? And this is a combination of, first and foremost, an ethical dilemma. So is it important to let them know that I have their data? It's also a factor here around how likely is it I'm going to get a good answer? How important is it given the nature of the site? How old is the data? How broadly is it circulating? Lots and lots and lots of different factors. One of the things I'm really conscious of is that the most time-consuming component, in terms of duration at least, for loading breaches is the communication with humans, particularly when it's humans who probably have never thought about data breaches before. And then there's this Aussie bloke who's just like, yeah, I've got all your data, and by the way, I run this service with like billions and billions of records. So it's a laborious process. Now, I reference Vigilante PW here because this was a breach listed on this site. And this site, if you go and have a look at vigilante.pw, it's just got gazillions of different breaches that are listed. Now, this is not a search site like Have I Been Pwned. It's just like a historical record of this company got breached. This is the sector they operate in. This is how many passwords are in there. I, as far as I know, don't think that service sort of goes out and does disclosure or things like that. But it is there on the public timeline. And when I find a reference for a service like this from years ago in a part of the world, which to be honest, is harder to get answers from if you're trying to reach out to an Indian company, and also when I see it reflected in other resources on the web as well. So there are lots of other places that were speaking about this breach having occurred. I couldn't find a breach notice from them, but I did find enough references that there is no sort of denying the fact that something happened. If you know what I mean, there's no like, well, we had absolutely no idea. It's it's extensively documented. So that's the case with Gardi. That was the first one. Now, the second one here, very different situation. World of Warcraft servers called Light's Hope. Only 30,000 records, but the big difference there is that the operator of that site reached out to me. I said, look, we got owned. You know, not good. Everyone's a little bit, I guess, not happy about this. Here's the data because it's circulating anyway. So this was, I think, the fourth self-submission that I've had to have I been pwned. So the fourth time an operator of a website that got owned has said, here's the data that was owned, load it, make it searchable. And they did an announcement, they did a breach notification. There's a page on their website, which is more than what I could find for Gardi. And they said, you know, here's the incident, we've submitted to have I been pwned, so you'll be able to search for your address there. So that's the second one. Third one, another Indian one. Indian bookings website called Yatra had 5 million records breached in 2013, including email and physical addresses, phone numbers, and plain text passwords and PINs. So here's a situation where it's not just passwords, it's also PINs, six-digit PINs from memory. So all of the passwords and the PINs have gone into pwned passwords as well, so they'll be searchable in the next set. And again, this was the same situation where I mentioned Vigilante PW. It's there. It's documented. I did find multiple other sites on the web. Some of them are search sites. Some of them are just documentation of who's had a breach mentioning this. So, you know, again, this is sort of the balance I'm striking. And if anyone has input on that, that doesn't make it harder for me and still allows me to sort of, you know, try and get the flow of data going so that people do know where they've been exposed, please let me know. There's several others that I'm presently going through this sort of side because there's hundreds of others. Several others I'm sort of in the process of doing disclosures for or trying to figure out what I actually need to do as well. So you'll see those pop up and have I been pwned in the coming days. Hopefully, if it's not too difficult. And this is what I constantly struggle with. It's like there's a whole bunch of innocent people in here. They really want to know about this. And I'm concerned about the process of notifying them because I want to do the right thing by the company, but I know how damn hard it is to get a good response from the company as well. Anyway, this is an evolving thing. I'm sure we'll see this change over time as well. Now, onto the Twitters, because the Twitters was where a lot of stuff happened for me this week. And earlier on in the week, I just found this interesting trend of a number of tweets just getting huge amounts of traction, retweets, likes, in numbers that are pretty exceptional, but then a whole bunch of them happened at once. So, you know, like 1,000+ likes, retweets, and so on. And I want to talk about what they are, because obviously they're things that resonated with people, and I think it's worth diving into them. Now, let's start with the controversial one. And really, this is not controversial for anyone, frankly, with half a clue, but let's go into it anyway. So I tweeted, when was this? This was 6 days ago, about HTTPS. And I said, I'm astounded to see people still arguing my site doesn't need HTTPS. So I'll put it simply. Either spend a few minutes putting it on your site now or continually explaining to your visitors why your site is not, then in quotes, not secure. Until you end up doing it anyway. It's not a negotiation. Now, frankly, this was in response to me just starting to run out of patience with the number of people arguing that their site doesn't need HTTPS. And, you know, to be clear, you don't have to put your site under HTTPS. Like, this is your own decision. You can make the call, and inevitably this is what many people are doing. But I see arguments that are just entirely baseless in terms of misunderstanding how the technology works. So, you know, I've got some notes here, and I'll give you some examples of this. So one of them is someone said, well, my site doesn't have JavaScript on it. So it doesn't need HTTPS. So it's like, well, mate, someone gets in the middle of your traffic, it's going to have JavaScript on it real quickly because that's exactly the sort of thing you can do. So this is a baseless argument. There was another tweet I shared from the Tor project. And in fact, when I shared this tweet, let me say I quote tweeted it. And I put in quotes in my quote tweet, but my site is just a personal blog and it doesn't need HTTPS and Google is evil and. Less whinging and more taking some responsibility. This tweet from Tor Project is precisely why securing every connection is so important. Now that tweet from the Tor Project talks about an article in which they uncovered a whole bunch of state-sponsored interception of plain text traffic and injection of nasty things. So they talk about UNI. Now, UNI, I just learned what UNI was before. This is O-O-N-I. UNI is the Open Observatory of Network Interference, a free software global observation network for detecting censorship, surveillance, and traffic manipulation on the internet, and it's run by the Tor Project. So this is basically looking at who is messing with our traffic. And of course, HTTPS is an important part of that, as is Tor, particularly in countries where censorship is rife. Now, some of the things they found here is they said they found that state-owned Telecom Egypt was using DPI, which is Deep Packet Inspection, so the ability to look at the packets flowing through your network, or similar, to hijack users' unencrypted HTTP connections and inject redirects to revenue-generating content such as affiliate ads. Kind of screwy when your government is redirecting you to ads. The Citizen Lab expanded upon this research, identifying the use of Sandvine packet logic devices and redirects being injected by at least 17 Egyptian ISPs. This doesn't happen by accident, right? This is a very concerted attempt to modify traffic. Now, they go on here and say the hijacking of unencrypted connections and the injection of redirects to affiliate ads and cryptocurrency mining sites. So people like the entire freaking government, by the sound of it, or a big whack of it, is injecting crypto miners in order to try and take a few little CPU cycles, mine themselves a bit of Monero or something. A wide range of different types of URLs were affected, including sites of the Palestinian Prisoner Society and the Women's Initiatives for Gender Justice, as well as LGBTQI, and then VP, I don't want to mix up all the acronyms, and VPN and Israeli sites. Even the sites of the United Nations, such as UN.org, were among those affected by redirects to ads. Does UN.org not have HTTPS? I'm going to look now. That's insane. I mean, just given the nature, holy shit, UN.org doesn't have HTTPS. And there's literally a picture of a guy carrying a gun on there as well. But yeah. And okay, that's a UN thing. Like they need the guns. I get that. But let's not turn this into a gun thing. But it doesn't have HTTPS. Wow, that's crazy. So, but you know, like this is the point where we're saying it doesn't matter what the site is. It doesn't matter whether it's your static cat video site or the freaking UN. If it's not served securely, traffic gets intercepted, things get changed. Now, I'll give you some examples of some of the screwy things that came up this week. So, I remember this one actually. It was on Saturday because I remember where I was when we had this tweet storm. So, someone was complaining about HTTPS, and their argument for not needing it is they said, I had HTTPS on my website. Users from China were having trouble accessing the site because the government was blocking it because they couldn't intercept and modify the traffic. So, I removed HTTPS. And I'm just going. Do you realize what you just said? Like, you know there is some malicious actor in the network trying to modify traffic, and the Chinese government has modified a lot of traffic in their time, particularly the sorts of things they were doing with Baidu and GitHub a few years ago. Google it if you don't know what I mean. They effectively created a massive DDoS cannon to try and blitz GitHub off the internet because they didn't like the projects GitHub was running. And they did this by users outside China who loaded Baidu, which is like their massive Google equivalent. When they loaded that insecure layer of HTTP, got script injected so that all these people outside China were trying to DDoS GitHub together. This is the sort of shit that happens when you don't protect your traffic. So this guy, who then very, very quickly blocked me, and you can go through and see all my tweets as well. They're very reasonable. I'm very, very conscious that people do go back and look at how I behave in tweets. But he blocked me, blocked a whole bunch of other people, started complaining about harassment because we're trying to explain that you really don't want malicious actors on your network injecting bad scripts and things like that into your pages. So he wasn't very happy. the other theme, this is a really interesting theme that's coming up, and I'll read exactly what my note is, then I'll explain a bit more. People are arguing that malware is worse, so why bother with HTTPS? Yeah, right. So they're sort of saying, because your machine might get owned anyway, or one person's example was because there are bad Chrome extensions, and there are bad Chrome extensions, but because of that, you can own the endpoint anyway, therefore HTTPS, like, what's the point? Because you just own the endpoint. But we've got to remember, these are really, really different risks. I saw people making the same argument about things like SQL injection. HTTPS won't stop SQL injection. Well, no, it won't, but it's not meant to. It is something entirely different. And having HTTPS or SQL injection defenses doesn't mean that you don't then need the other thing. Like, you need to do all these things. This is the way the internet works today. You defend against different risks in different ways, and you do need to try and do them all. Keep in mind as well here, we're not talking about you really need to go out and spend $50 million on some massive crazy network appliance to make this work. We're talking, as per the video series I released last year, what is usually a 5-minute free job. Particularly the people arguing about this are sitting on basic, simple websites, which literally are a free 5-minute job. So, people. Now, there was just really weird things. Like someone saying, it won't stop tracking. People still track me if I put HTTPS, or rather, people will still track my customers if I put HTTPS on the website. These are two different things again. Like, why are you trying to, or why are you worried about tracking and HTTPS? Like, if you don't want your visitors being tracked, don't put Google Analytics on there or Disqus or whatever it is that has elements of tracking. Yes, I'm aware I'll use both of those, but I've got HTTPS, so it's fine. Joke. So the point seems to be the continual conflation of issues. And there's another one here. Someone got rather irate. This was just yesterday. Because they said, I didn't have HTTPS on my site years ago. So it's hypocritical for me to now say that other people should. Well, yeah, but I didn't have a content security policy years ago. I didn't have certificate authority authorizations years ago. I didn't have XSS headers years ago. Like, all of these other things didn't happen years ago. But what's happened over time is a combination of the threat landscape changing. We're seeing a lot more interception and the sorts of things that I just raised here with the Egypt scenario. We're also seeing a lot more freely available, readily accessible HTTPS, which makes mitigation easier. And of course, we're also seeing changes in the browser, which have been happening really since about January last year, which are increasingly warning people when you don't have HTTPS. So things change. The industry changes. My views certainly change as well. And I really couldn't give a shit about what I did or did not do years ago based on what it now does today. And in fact, to be honest, moving away from the old platform from Blogger to Ghost was a heap of work. Like, this was not a trivial task. It was a major thing to pick that whole site up with hundreds and hundreds of blog posts and redo all the theme and all that sort of stuff and move it over. And HTTPS was one of the main things that pushed me to do it, because I wanted to have it so badly on my site for all the reasons we all know it is good. Here's a great one. I'm going to need a drink before this. For those listening to the podcast, this is not a drink of the kind I'll be taking in later. This is cappuccino latte. There was a really interesting one you ever feel sometimes you just keep giving people more and more and more rope, you know, or they just keep digging and digging and digging? There was someone yesterday, and I won't say who it is. You can go back to my tweets and have a look. You'll work it out later on anyway. Who was just absolutely adamant that HTTPS was unnecessary or a bad idea, or effectively just wasn't needed on a static site. A lot of talk about not needing it on static sites. And, you know, normally what happens is a couple of people don't see eye to eye on something. Yeah, maybe one of them's right, one of them's wrong. I don't know. It doesn't matter. The point is they don't see eye to eye. You go backwards and forwards a little bit, and then everyone goes off and does their things. This guy had a huge amount of energy because the discussion went beyond me, and all these other people joined in the discussion. This wasn't me sort of, you know, rallying the masses either. Just people saw the tweets and things that were happening. And I ended up going, I've got to step back out of this conversation. This is just getting crazy. But this guy just continually backing this position that it just wasn't needed. And in a really weird way too, because I'd sort of look at things like, there's a great website, does my site need https.com? Fantastic site that first of all says yes, and then explains very clearly why with lots of industry examples. And I'd sort of point this guy to the section about, this is just a static site, doesn't need HTTPS. And it very clearly gives examples like the interception I just spoke about. And I'd sort of say, look, do you think this doesn't apply? You know, like, yes or no. It's a yes or no question. Just couldn't draw an answer. Eventually, I think he invited myself or others to demonstrate the problem with the lack of HTTPS. And I'm going to talk about what I'm going to do with that later. And then went and said, if someone does that, he'd sue them under GDPR. So first of all, this is not how GDPR works. And in fact, the irony of this is that GDPR is working very much around protecting the data of the individuals who use services like this. So to say, I'm not going to protect their data, and then if you try to demonstrate that I'm not protecting their data, I'm going to come and get you under the regulation which is designed to protect the people I'm not protecting, you know, in the first place. So that was a little bit hard to follow, if I'm honest. However, on that, I do now have plans to do a demo. In fact, I wanted to do a demo site. I wanted to do, or rather a demo video. It needed to be a video. Wanted to do a demo video of, let's just take the most benign static site we can think of and show just how badly it can get messed up with traffic interception. And in fact, I put out a tweet last night, my time, and I said, here are the things I'm thinking of doing in this demo. So it'd be things like everything from injecting a crypto miner. Obviously, you want to Rickroll the thing for fun, but we do also want to show serious risks too. So let's use a bit of Beef, the browser exploitation framework, which allows you to put a hook on a page via JavaScript and then push social logins to them, push flash updates, all sorts of stuff. Many people said Goatsy. If you don't know what that is, don't Google it. Just trust me. No, I won't do that. I appreciate the sentiment. I know where you're going with it. I have other ideas to make an impact that you can still look at in front of your children or anybody else. So I'm going to do a whole bunch of demos. So if you have good ideas about what would be impactful as a demo on a static site, and I will do it on this guy's site because I think he eventually sort of said, yeah, it's okay, but gee, who knows? We'll just do it anyway. So I will try and do that over the weekend or early next week, hopefully. I want to really carefully think this through because I would love this to become the canonical resource for every time someone says, my site's static and doesn't need HTTPS. So I want to make it impactful. A good piece of news related to HTTPS, let's look at the positive, is that there's a lady called Deborah Edwards Onoro who is translating the four-part HTTPS is Easy video series I did last week. Now, Google can do closed captions. It can generate the text. Apparently, it's terrible. So she is actually going through and writing the whole thing out. So and she's submitting that as a community contribution. So I opened up all the four videos to allow community contributions, also allowed Creative Commons redistribution with attribution. So you can take this and put in your internal networks, whatever, which is cool. So I really like this because she's investing her own time to try and make this accessible to more people. And that's fantastic. So big thank you to her. Apparently she's done part two as well, but it's not showing up on Google somewhere. I'll accept that, and I'm sure she'll be doing three and four after that. All right, let's move on to funner tweets. Funner tweets? More fun tweets? It's been a long week. And just incidentally, because I was sort of talking about the numbers, that one about me being astounded to see people still arguing has had nearly 1,600 likes, which is quite a lot for me. That's a lot of likes. The next one, which is just about to tick over 1,000 likes, is this. This is from the weekend, so it makes sense now. Also kind of related to HTTPS. I put in quotes, why do you need so much beer? And there's a photo of my beer fridge. And this like, it does have a lot of beer in it. And like, not the crap kind either. I've got lots of variety in here. There's even some wine in there as well, just to mix it up a little bit. So why do you need so much beer? And then I've said, because read my timeline for the last 12 hours arguing with people about HTTPS. And I was kind of astounded to see nearly 1,000 likes already for basically just a photo of a beer fridge and then saying, read my tweets about HTTPS. That gives you an indication of just how bloody painful these discussions have been. So the beer fridge was good. Now, there's another one here. I think this is the winner so far in terms of likes so far this week. So this is from the 1st. So we're back there on Sunday. Now, I was processing a data breach. This was actually the Gardaí data breach, the one I mentioned before, the Indian one, motoring site. 2,001 likes for this tweet. Now, I said, I'll tell you what's in the image first, and I will link to all of these in the video too. The image is a SQL statement creating a table called users. In the table called users, there is a column called password and another column called password MD5. And it is exactly what it sounds like. They were populated with the plain text password and an MD5 hash of the password. There's also plain text users, and there's a column called username, plain text, obviously, and a column called username underscore MD5, which is also exactly what it sounds like. I have not seen this before. I have had a number of pen testers pop up and say they have seen it before. I've certainly not seen it in any of the data breaches I've dealt with. I don't know why you do this. Some people said, oh, maybe they were doing like a rollover of their hashing algorithm. Well, it's not a rollover of the hashing algorithm, the rollover of their password storage mechanism from plain text to MD5, which would be terrible anyway. And they just left the old column there. And we have seen this pattern in the industry many times before. So for example, the Dropbox data breach had a whole bunch of passwords in SHA-1, a whole bunch of them in bcrypt. And evidently they were doing the rollover. But when you're rolling over from one hashing algorithm to another, there is a process, unless you just rehash everything in one go, there is a process of people logging in, validating, authenticating them, taking that password they just provided, and then hashing it with the new algo and storing that. So there is a rollover process. There is no process when it's plain text. In fact, it's very easy when it's plain text, because you just go and hash everything again. So that was kind of screwy. Many people also pointed out that the MD5 column had a length of 200, which is about 168 characters longer than an MD5 hash. So there's that. They also pointed out that the user ID column is an int 200. True story. So the funny things you see. One of the things actually that this makes me often think about is, imagine if all of your code and all of your database and all of your data was one day publicly visible. And there's one part of this which is, you know, this is going to be devastating in terms of data exposure and everything, but there's another part of it in terms of how much of a dick would you look like? And trust me, there's like lots of code that I have, not like this, mind you, but lots of code I have where I'm like, if someone sees what I'm doing and this ends up on like, I don't know, Slashdot one day, it's like, look how shit Troy's code is. Some of it does look pretty terrible. But again, not this level of terrible, but it does get me thinking about what if one day all your code was public code. Not intentionally either. I'm not talking about open source stuff here, but stuff that people did not want to be public. All right, so that's that one. Now, next one. Now, this was kind of interesting because this had a lot of traction in the press here in Australia. I got multiple queries from the press here, but I did see it in the international news as well. And the headline here, this is in the Sydney Morning Herald, which is a Sydney newspaper. The headline is, Google allows companies to read Gmail users' inboxes. And the byline says, Google allows employees at software companies to read millions of Gmail users' private messages. It has emerged. Now, my tweet says, I've had multiple media requests for comments on this, which surprises me because it seems so obvious. If you grant an app permission to read your email, it can read your email. That also means it may show parts of it to other humans. Code can do that. Because this story is not like circumventing the access controls when an app asks for access to your email, or if it's an app that integrates OAuth style into your Gmail and it says this app would like to read your mail, etc. It's not circumventing this. This is people using the controls precisely as they're meant to be used, and then going, oh, someone else was able to read my email after I granted them access to read my email. I think that the distinction here, in fact, there's a few distinctions. One of the distinction is there seems to be a different perception of computers reading email versus humans reading email. Now, I get that to a degree, insofar as people are saying, look, when I granted this app access to say, my calendar, I thought it would be able to create events, which is part of the natural flow of what the app does because it needs to. It's like a workout app and I coordinate with my friends and we all go to the same gym or something using this app in the calendar. I get the sentiment that it's one thing for the app to do that. It would be another if the humans running the workout app were sitting there looking at my workout schedule. So I understand where it's coming from. I don't agree with it because you need to understand that once you give an app access to data such as calendar or email or contacts is another very popular one, then that's going to be problematic. There is always going to be that potential. So that was the first thing. The other thing that came up is I think people just fundamentally understand the purpose of these challenges that we get about will you grant access to something on your device or some other online account. And I do get that because let's face it, we get bombarded with information. And even for people like you and I who are, you're probably technical like I am, I'm sure we see things and we just see so many of them that we don't always understand the full implications of them. Now, I'll give you an example of this, and this is one I did actually reject. During the week, someone set up a teleconference with me, and it was using an AT&T service. And one of the options was to download the AT&T app onto your phone. So I thought, okay, well, I'll do that because that will allow me to have a VoIP call and I won't pay for international charges to make a phone call, etc. The AT&T app requested access to my calendar. And I'm like, no, you're not getting access to my calendar. And then it wouldn't work. And I was like, well, surely you can just skip that. And it just doesn't do the calendar integration bit, but it does the other things. And I just couldn't get it to work. And when I say I couldn't get it to work, I could not get past that challenge which required access to the calendar. And I think what it was trying to do is it wanted to look at your calendar to find the meeting such that it could then, I guess, make it easier to connect to the bridge. I didn't install that app, so I ended up rejecting it. I ended up doing a Skype out call and just paying a few cents to make the call out over the old classic phone lines. But you can see the challenge, right? Particularly in a case like that, where I'm sitting there going, my meeting's about to start, like I've got to jump on this thing, otherwise I'm going to be late. I just need to accept this one thing. So I understand how this happens. I also saw people chiming in on this. Incidentally, this has 704 likes, this tweet, but it was only yesterday. So I've had a little bit less time to run yet. I also saw people chiming in to the effect of saying you should never grant this access or this model shouldn't be there or app developers shouldn't be asking for this. But the thing is that there are valid use cases where apps need to access things on your device. I mean, location's another perfect example. There are lots of apps which work much better if they know where you're located. Real estate apps, perfect example. Things like Yelp, when you're trying to find restaurants or something like that around you, work much better if they can access location. There are places, or rather circumstances, where accessing contacts, calendars, this sort of thing makes sense as well. A flashlight app is not one of them, because this is the other problem. We have got so much crap out there in the app stores, and certainly there has been over the years, so many examples of things like a flashlight needing access to your contacts. This is... why? But people will install it and they'll click through the prompts and now here we are. Now, one more on the theme of good things that happened this week. And this one is up to 980 likes on this one. So tweet says, I woke up at 1 a.m. unable to sleep with all these coding ideas for Have I Been Pwned? I'm going to talk about those shortly too. In my head, eventually just decided to get up at 3:30 and start work on this, only to find this email. This is nice. This email is my MVP renewal email, which means I get to put another one just there. And for the people on the podcast, I'm pointing at a gap on my wall where there is an eighth MVP certificate to come. So this is really cool. Microsoft does renewals for the MVP award on the 1st of July every year. This will be the eighth one for me, so I've had it since 2011, April 1st, 2011. So in fact, it's seven and a little bit years now. And look, this is just a really nice thing to have. It's a nice community to be a part of. The recognition is always really nice. That the MVP award is something that came to me very early on in, I guess, my modern career, for want of a better term. It was after I'd done that OWASP Top 10 series, blog series. So, in fact, probably the big thing that got me really security focused was in 2010. I did the 10-part series of the OWASP Top 10 for ASP.NET developers. And I also put it out as a free ebook as well, still available there to download today. Google it. Actually, it's in the blog post. So this is transitioning now from the last tweet that was popular to the one blog post I wrote this week too. So yeah, I did the top 10 thing and that got me the award. And it was only after I got the first award, which would be the one there, that I sort of started going, well, I guess I've probably got to go and do some talks and stuff like that, because that's what you do when you get an MVP award. And really that was the genesis for everything that I do today. And it is honestly a pivotal moment in terms of why I'm now sitting here and doing stuff like this and Have I Been Pwned and all the travel and everything, as opposed to in my normal career or in a job in an office. So the MVP award has been enormously important to me, and I'm super, super stoked to have that again. Now, I mentioned I was awake at 1 a.m. thinking about, have I been pwned? I think I was just on the very tail end of jet lag as well, which I am now claiming is gone. But what's been on my mind is I'm moving a whole bunch of stuff into Azure Functions, and I'm moving stuff off the primary website into Functions. So if you recall, all of Pwn Passwords runs on Azure Functions. It's absolutely smashing it. In fact, I haven't looked today. We'll check the stats. But when I say smashing it, it's having huge amounts of traffic going through it, which are increasing really, really rapidly. A huge amount of that traffic's being caught by Cloudflare. And then what's happening is a small amount of that traffic, low single-digit percentages, is coming through to my Origin website, which is running off Azure Functions and running very, very efficiently. So for example, last 24 hours, 8.6 million requests to Cloudflare, which is great. So I'm now seeing a steady 8 to 9 million requests every 24 hours, certainly during the work week, for Pwn Passwords. 92% of those served by Cloudflare cache. 8% going to Functions. Functions are just executing super fast. I shared some figures on that, I think, last week about what it's costing me, which is just stupid money, like a dollar a day kind of thing to run this. So the Functions are awesome. I also pushed out Functions for the 1Password and Firefox feature that I announced last week as well. So that runs off Functions. And I'm looking at how I can move particularly the API components of Have I Been Pwned also into Functions. Several reasons for this. Number one is I want to get away from the old paradigm of the web app having to scale up and scale down based on load. Because what happens at the moment, and I will blog all of this in detail as well, is a sudden influx of load happens. And this could be, Have I Been Pwned's been on the TV somewhere, and there's a lot of people, it could be it's in the news. It could be someone's just hammering the bejesus out of the API. And what happens is this load just goes whack like this, and my CPU goes super, super high in a very, very short period, and response times go down. Sometimes there's going to be a loss of requests if that load is high enough. And then Azure goes, oh, you need another instance. Put another instance on. And then it comes down a little bit. And then it has to wait 5 minutes before doing it. So it's this very staggered kind of scale, which several years ago when I set all this up was awesome. And it's still very, very good today. But Functions being serverless and scaling in a totally linear fashion are fantastic. Someone made a comment the other day, something along the lines of, with serverless, you don't think about sort of designing for scale anymore, you think about designing for cost. I forget exactly how they put it, but it was effectively saying you never have to think about what causes it to scale, how much infrastructure do I need. You're thinking more about how do I just make that function execution super, super efficient. So by moving things like the API to Functions, I can get away from that problem with the crazy scale stuff. That will reduce my cost because I won't be paying every time there's a new instance that comes on. It will also reduce my cost because I don't think I'll need to run a large web server anymore. I'll be able to drop it down to probably a medium. Now that's going to halve the cost of that web server. So at the moment, I think I'd have to check my figures. It's like $250 or something a month for that web server. And then of course, every instance you add on kind of doubles that for the period that it runs. It's also going to be much more reliable and it's going to be faster because we're never going to have the problem of the thing just getting hammered. So I'm doing a combination of there's some Redis sitting in the back end to avoid database hits so that function will never need to hit a database. I'm asyncing a lot of things that I wasn't asyncing before. I've been testing this actively over the last few days. I'm going to start rolling this out hopefully over the weekend. Now, this is not going to impact anyone who is using the API. Let me just make that clear. If you're using the documented APIs on Have I Been Pwned, nothing is going to change, nothing is going to break. Part of the way I'm going to make sure that that is the case is because as I roll stuff out more and more and more towards Functions, I can use Cloudflare workers to redirect traffic. So the functions actually run on a totally different domain or a different subdomain. But I can take requests coming into Cloudflare, I can use a worker and say, hey, instead of going to that old API, go over there to the new one. So workers are going to be the mechanism which help me do that rollover in a totally seamless way. It's also going to give me a lot more control over things like handling abuse of the API. So if you are abusing the API, you know who you are if you're doing it. It does happen from time to time. It's going to get harder once I have more logic and more controls built in at the edge as well, so I don't even have to process them at the origin. So all of that is good stuff. And I've got a heap of other things along those lines, sort of a little bit further back in the pipeline, in the backlog that is in my mind at the moment as well. So I'll be doing all those over the coming days. You'll see some changes. And again, I will share that and blog it extensively when it's done. I'm sort of having this blog idea in mind, which is sort of like modern architectures for scale. And it's things like going serverless, things like controlling traffic flow at the edge. Breaking how I've been pwned down into smaller components has also been awesome. So the fact that pwn passwords is totally self-contained, has its own functions, has its own storage account. I could pick it up and do whatever I want with it. Something going crazy over here doesn't make it go crazy over there. These sort of patterns are really, really super cool too. So I'm going to write all these up later on. All right, last thing this week is the sponsor is Gold Security. So Gold Security has been sponsoring me for quite some time now. They are up there in the sponsor bar again today. So I appreciate them being a very regularly recurring sponsor. They'll be there a few more times this year as well. And this year is booked out into next year already. I've had a lot of people asking about sponsorship. I need to get better with the way I plan this, because I sold out all of 2018 in the space of a few days, so I really wasn't doing a very good job, I think, of pricing it all or letting information, letting availability feed out at the right rate. So I will start to think about that more carefully, particularly, I think, as we get through to about September period. And that is it. So thank you very much for watching this. I'm going to link to all of those tweets and things. I will hopefully next week have the example of all the nasty things you can do with a static site as well. That's going to be a lot of fun. Hopefully very educational for people as well. I hope everyone has an awesome weekend, and I'll come back to you again next week.